Journal for Saturday, October 28th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Community Rallies Support Student, Teen Hurt in Saturday Hunting Accident. In picture after picture in Joe Salmon's senior photo gallery, a big smile crosses his face. It's a smile that can light up a room, one of his coaches said, and make everyone feel welcome and liked. It's typical of a young man who can be super serious at times, but also loves to have fun, his aunt said. He's just special. He's the type of person that you meet him, and it's a connection, Jess Alexander said of her 18-year-old nephew. His connection to his community became evident this week after the Okoboji High School senior was accidentally shot in a hunting accident Saturday morning. Already, tens of thousands of dollars have been donated to various funds to help the family with medical expenses. T-shirts sporting a picture of Joe drawn by one of his young fans are being sold. Other fundraisers and benefits continue to pop up. It's surreal, the response and how quickly they banded together and said that we have to do something, Axler said. This kind of response isn't something you'd expect, and yet here we are. They are where no family ever wishes to be. Friday night, Joe was playing his final football game, a loss in the state playoffs. Earlier Saturday morning, he went hunting waterfowl with two friends at the Spring Run Wildlife Area in Dickinson County. Joe's been living with his aunt and uncle, Axler's sister and brother-in-law, since spring. Axler was at her sister's home Saturday morning when Joe's friends called and asked, and Axler could hear the hysterical voice over the phone. All of a sudden, I hear, "Joe's been shot," Axler said. Her sister rushed to the scene, where Joe was airlifted to a Sioux Falls hospital and underwent surgery to remove one of the three birdshot pellets that entered the left side of his skull when one of his hunting companions accidentally shot him. Surgeons had to leave the other two because they were too deep in his brain. A decision on whether to remove them will be made later. He remains in intensive care and is yet to wake up, but he's squeezing visitors' hands and on Wednesday began breathing on his own and as his condition continues to improve. In the immediate aftermath, so much was uncertain, but Axler was certain of one thing. She didn't want Joe to be stuck under a mountain of medical debt. She went on GoFundMe, an online fundraising site, and set up a page for Joe, hoping to raise a little bit of money to help pay the expenses of health insurance won't cover. I had no idea what to expect, she said. She started with a $1,000 goal. Within 2 hours, more than $1,500 had been donated. She raised the goal to $5,000, and donations continued to stream in. A couple hours later, she'd raised the goal to $10,000. Within 6 hours, $15,000 had been donated, so she raised the goal to $30,000, and on Monday evening, it pushed to $50,000. As of Thursday afternoon, more than $36,000 had been donated. That total doesn't include what's been sent to other benefit funds or raised by other businesses and individuals. That so many people have responded is a testament to Joe's character, which was on full display earlier this year. In February, he jumped into the icy waters of East Lake Okoboji and along with four others rescued a driver and his dog after their Jeep went through the ice. His heroism gained national attention. In a nutshell, that's Joe, seeing a need spring into action, said Nick Mulder, the Okoboji School District Activities Director and co-head football coach. It's typical of Joe's quiet leadership, Mulder said. He's not a big talker, preferring to let his actions and determination speak for themselves. An attitude that's noticed by teammates and fellow students. There was not a kid on our team that would tell you that Joe isn't a nice guy, Mulder said. He walks in a room and he'll make you feel better. Joe faces a long recovery, and Axler said her nephew likely will face it with determination, just as he does everything else. With his goal of earning an athletic scholarship to help make college possible, Joe avoided the party scene. He won't even drink caffeine. As he told Axler, "I have plans." Those plans include playing football next year at Simpson College and studying engineering. It's too early to say how Joe's accident will affect those plans, but Axler doubts the track sprinter will allow it to slow him down. Time will tell, but in the present, Joe's family continues to marvel at the support they've received. It's been a rough couple days, but at the same time, it's been extremely humbling at times and overwhelming, Axler said. Joe, too, will be humbled once he learns of all the support he and his family have received, she said. It's sure to bring that well-known smile to his face. Now on to a very different article. Court documents: Sioux City woman stabbed grandmother with a butcher knife. A Sioux City woman is dead after her granddaughter stabbed her multiple times Thursday with a butcher knife, according to court documents. Jessica L. Bino, 32, and her mother, Angela M. Bino, 59, have both been charged with first-degree murder after a deceased woman was discovered Thursday evening in a parking lot of an apartment complex near downtown. Sioux City police responded to the parking lot in the 600 block of Virginia Street at 11:54 p.m. The victim was pronounced dead at the scene upon the paramedics' arrival. The Sioux City Police Department has not released the name and age of the victim. Court identifies her as Suzette E. Ochibone. According to the documents filed in Woodbury County District Court, at approximately 7 p.m., Thursday, Jessica Bino was in an apartment at the complex where she lived with her grandmother, who was the victim, and her mother, Angela Bino. The documents stated that Jessica Bino was in the living room, arguing with the victim. Then, Angela Bino, who was in the bedroom, went to the living room and confronted the victim. Both women began assaulting the victim with their fists. Angela Bino told police that she grabbed a glass candlestick and struck the victim approximately 6 times in the face, and also struck the victim with a hammer in the face and arms, according to the documents. Jessica Bino allegedly went to the kitchen, retrieved a butcher knife, and then returned to the living room. The defendant stabbed the victim multiple times in the head, chest, and face, documents said. At 11:54 p.m. Thursday, a witness observed Jessica and Angela Bino dragging the victim to a silver Buick LeSabre and attempting to put the victim in the trunk, according to the documents. Jessica and Angela Bino was currently being held at the Woodbury County Jail in lieu of $500,000 bond. They are scheduled to appear in court for a preliminary hearing on November 6th. Anyone with information relating to the incident can contact the Sioux City Police Department at 712-279-6440 or the anonymous tip line at 712-258-8477. Now let's go on to another very different article. DC pandas will return to China early. The National Zoo's three celebrity giant pandas will be heading home a little earlier than expected. Zoo officials told the Associated Press that the adult bears Mai Xiang and Tian Tian and their cub Xiao Quili will be returning to China sometime in mid-November. The zoo's exchange agreement with the Chinese government, originally brokered by President Richard Nixon 50 years ago, expires December 7th. Ongoing negotiations to extend the agreement haven't produced results amid speculation from China watchers that Beijing is gradually pulling its pandas from Western nations due to deteriorating diplomatic relations with the U.S. and other countries. Pandophiles around the country had circled the December date as the last chance to view the iconic bears, but the zoo, for undisclosed reasons, said the departure will happen about 3 weeks earlier. Discussions with our Chinese partner, the China Wildlife Conservation Association, to develop a future giant panda program will likely start after the current pandas have returned to China, a zoo spokesperson, Annalisa Meyer, said in an email. After 51 years of success, we remain committed to giant panda conservation, It's our intention to have giant pandas at the zoo again, and we'll continue our research here and conservation work back in China. The bears have been a wildly popular attraction and an unofficial symbol of the nation's capital for decades. Every birthday and anniversary was an occasion for public celebration, and the long-shot birth of Xiao Guili in the midst of the pandemic in August 2020 drove millions of viewers to the zoo's panda cam. Zoo officials say they remain hopeful that they will come to a new agreement with the Chinese government. The San Diego Zoo returned its pandas in 2019, and the last bear at the Memphis, Tennessee Zoo went home earlier this year. The departure of the National Zoo's bears would mean that only giant pandas left in America are at the Atlanta Zoo, and that loan agreement expires late next year. Beijing currently lends out 65 pandas to 19 countries through cooperative research programs with a stated mission to better protect the vulnerable species. The pandas return to China when they reach old age, and any cubs born in the United States are sent to China around the age of 3 or 4. Now let's go on to a more local article. Siouxland welcomes new citizens. 30 people from 12 countries naturalized Thursday. Almost right up to the moment she'd been longing for years, Sioux City resident Violet Naformi Ahiokioa was filling out paperwork. She was making sure every last bit of her information was correct before she took the next step in the journey, which began in Cameroon a decade ago. Ayakoya was one of 30 area residents who became U.S. citizens during a naturalization ceremony at the Mary J. Treglia Community House in Sioux City today, Thursday. "It's one of the most exciting moments in my life. Become a U.S. citizen," she said. "It's something that I've been longing for, and I'm happy that it happened today." The 30 residents who became naturalized on Thursday hailed from Cameroon, Cuba, the Democratic Republic of Congo, El Salvador, Ethiopia, Guatemala, Haiti, Laos, Mexico, Myanmar, and Vietnam. When welcoming them and 70 other attendees who showed up to the gymnasium of the community house, Mary J. Treglia Executive Director Barb Newhouse shared what they should be most fluent in. "Your smile is your first language," Newhouse said at the beginning of the ceremony, which also included a performance of the Star Spangled Banner and the Oath of Allegiance and a video message for President Joe Biden. According to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, in fiscal year 2022, 967,500 people became American citizens in ceremonies across the country and around the world. This is a 20% increase from last year and the highest number of naturalizations we've seen since the fiscal year 2008, the USCIS said. Iowa saw 4,097 naturalizations in the fiscal year 2022, with the greatest number from one country coming from Mexico, 553 in total. Though the Mary J. Treglia Community House is no stranger to holding such events, Newhouse said, the Thursday gathering was the first of the year for the organization. Sioux City Police Officer Eddie Thipasok gave the keynote speech for the citizenship ceremony and offered his own personal story of immigrating from Laos to a refugee camp in Thailand, eventually to Sioux City in the early 2000s. "I know how difficult the process can be," Thipasok told the crowd. He then added, "One of the things he's proudest to say to people now is, I am a U.S. citizen." The oath itself, which Thipasok had to say years ago, begins, "I hereby declare an oath that I absolutely and I entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any other foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty of whom or which I have heretofore been a subject or citizen." Newhouse, while reading a congratulatory letter from the Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, acknowledged stories such as Thipasok's and those of new citizens are crucial threads in the national tapestry. The collective journeys of countless Americans make up what is truly the American spirit, Ernst's letter said. Staffers for U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra and Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley were in attendance, as well as let the 30 people being recognized know that they could come to the legislator's office with any federally related issues. Your citizenship guarantees your constitutional rights and your freedoms. Protect and cherish them, Feenstra staffers and Ann Hughes reminded them. Iaikoya, who came to the Sioux City from California, had a similar sentiment. The Unity Point Health St. Luke's nurse said, what she appreciates most about America is the diversity of experiences of citizens. People have different cultures and different colors, and it's something really welcoming, Iaikoya said. As to what she is most looking forward to now, that she's a U.S. citizen, Iaikoya says that she hopes to further her career in ways that she wouldn't have been able to before her naturalization ceremony. When reflecting on the event after it had been concluded, Newhouse again talked about smiles and the sorts of plans that people such as Iaikoya have. It just warms my heart to see us welcome new people as U.S. citizens and allow them to become successful in America. Jared McNett is an online editor and reporter for the Sioux City Journal. You can reach him at 712-293-4234 and follow him on Twitter at twoheadedboy98. Now let's move on to more of a state article. Iowa Governor Reynolds defends library book restriction law as school pulls books from shelves. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds defended a state law that requires schools to pull books with description of sex acts from library shelves during a press conference on Wednesday, as the state's Department of Education said that it may provide more guidance to schools navigating the restrictions. The law, passed by Iowa's legislative Republicans and signed into law by Reynolds this year, requires that school libraries only include age-appropriate material and specifically bans any books that describes or depicts any of a list of defined sex acts. The law also requires schools to notify parents if a student requests to be called a different name set or gender pronouns, and bans teaching about gender identity or sexual orientation in kindergarten through sixth grade. Schools must also provide a policy to request removal of any classroom materials and requests parental permission before a student takes a survey or exam to assess the student's mental or emotional physical health, and it's not required by state or federal law. Reynolds reads the list of sex acts written in law that would warrant a removal from libraries, and said the standards should be clear on what is and not allowed in schools. I'm not sure why any kindergartner or anybody in school should be subjected to that, and what value that it brings to them, Reynolds said. So that's the definition. It's very, very clear. According to a database maintained by the Des Moines Register, districts in Iowa have removed at least 450 books from their shelves in response to the law. Many districts have removed commonly challenged books like Gender Queer and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, books that are often assigned high school reading like George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, have also been pulled in several districts. Education and library advocates have argued that an overly broad interpretation of the law by school districts trying to avoid legal repercussions will lead to schools pulling off materials off shelves that should not be removed under the law, depriving students of the opportunity to read books that they otherwise would. Speaking about the removal of commonly assigned books, Reynolds suggested the school districts are implementing broad restrictions because they don't like the law, and she said that the books that fall under the definition of a sex act in law should be clear. I think it's pretty clear, and if they can't distinguish that, then I don't know. Maybe we have to look at what they should be dealing with, Reynolds said. It's just a distraction, and they don't like it, so they're blowing it out of proportions. Reynolds chided the effort to remove books with sexual content from schools to the need to boost scores in reading, math, and other areas that have lagged because of learning loss from the pandemic. Our kids and our teachers deserve better, she said. They deserve the tools to help these kids succeed. Not a distraction on a nasty pornographic book that should never be in a, ever be in a classroom. State Board of Education may provide guidance. The Iowa State Board of Education has until December 28th to begin promulgating rules to implement several provisions of the law. However, it remains unclear whether state officials will issue new rules or guidance related to removing school library materials and instruction related to sexual orientation or gender identity that's now barred in kindergarten through sixth grade. Heather Doe, communications director for the Iowa Department of Education, did not immediately respond to questions seeking clarification to which provisions of the law for which the State Board of Education will promulgate rules. The Department of Education also did not provide a timeline for when Iowa school districts will receive new rules. Penalties for violating the law take effect January 1, 2024. State officials will give first-time offenders a written warning. Subsequent violations can lead to superintendents and employees being called before the Iowa Board of Education examiners for a hearing and possible disciplinary action, according to the law. Iowa Department of Education officials this summer left vague their plans to give school administrators more guidance on what constitutes age-appropriate material and which books would or would not fall under the definition, including materials referencing any type of gender identity and sexual orientation. The board's president, during a meeting this summer, noted that school officials and administrators across the state have clamored for guidance from the department in implementing the law, in part to avoid the possibility of litigation over book removals. Melissa Peterson, legislative and policy director with the Iowa State Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, said that by her reading the law, it does not compel rulemaking by the state board related to school library materials, but it does for other less controversial provisions. Left to seek their own legal guidance, some schools initially removed hundreds of books, while others have waited, hoping for direction from the state before law penalties go into effect January 1st. Peterson pointed to the Urbandale Community School District, which paused its initial removal of nearly 400 books from the shelves that may violate the law, narrowing down the list to 64 titles after a more careful review. The Iowa City Community School District this month released a list of about 70 book titles removed from schools to comply with the new law. The list includes Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, which tells the story of a young black girl after the Great Depression, and Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, a futuristic dystopian novel set in the patriarchal white supremacist totalitarian state, which has overthrown the U.S. It also includes A Thousand Acres, a novel written by Jane Smiley, a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. Peterson said the ISEA continues to be disappointed that the Iowa Department of Education has not issued better guidance to the school on how to navigate the thornier provisions of the law. Peterson said that she's cautiously optimistic the State Board of Education will compel the department to issue guidance at its next meeting, November 15th. We have a lot of work ahead of us in public education, and when you take into consideration staff shortages and the needs of students, unnecessary distractions are not appreciated at this point, Peterson said. And we think this issue in particular has been a significant distraction that could easily be removed with clear guidance from the Department of Education. We shouldn't be making it harder for folks to do their job and be in compliance. Now on to another politics article. Iowa's Grassley said 40 people gave FBI criminal information about Biden family. Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley is seeking information from the Department of Justice and FBI about whether they properly vetted what he says were dozens of people who provided federal investigators with confidential criminal information related to the foreign business dealings of President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and other family members. The allegations were outlined in a letter published Wednesday from Grassley, to Attorney General Merrick Garland and the FBI Director Chris Wray. Citing anonymous whistleblower disclosures, Grassley said that he has been made aware that the FBI had at one point maintained more than 40 confidential human sources who had criminal information about President Joe Biden and his son Hunter and James Biden, the president's brother. An essential question that must be answered is this: did the FBI investigate the information or shut it down? Indeed, if those sources were improperly shut down, it wouldn't be out of the ordinary for the FBI, Grassley wrote. The FBI confirmed that it had received Grassley's letter, but said that it had no other comment. The Department of Justice and White House did not immediately respond to requests for comment Thursday. Grassley's request comes as the House Republicans pursue an impeachment inquiry into President Biden over allegations that he abused his authority when he was vice president to personally profit his family's many foreign business dealings. Part of the House GOP's inquiry involves examining how the DOJ handled its own parallel investigation into the Hunter Biden after whistleblowers alleged the investigation had been slow-walked by the department officials to protect the Bidens. Grassley, in the letters, accuses the department of stonewalling him on the issue since 2019, before Biden took office in 2021. He wrote the investigative activity was scuttled by the FBI in 2020 while former President Donald Trump was in office, and asserts that such decision points to a significant political bias. The allegations against the Biden family were investigated by the Department of Justice under Trump-appointed Republican Attorney General William Barr as part of an investigation into allegations of bribery brought by Trump's then-personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. The Justice Department found no supporting evidence of the allegations and closed the investigation in August 2022, according to a statement from Representative Jamie Raskin, the ranking member of the House Oversight Committee. Barr denies closing the investigation and told the Federalist this summer the information was ultimately forwarded to the U.S. Attorney in Delaware. Republicans have questioned whether the federal prosecutors there followed up on the allegations. An FD 1023 form used the FBI to log unverified accounts from confidential human sources, states the source, is not able to provide information as to the veracity of assertions related to any alleged bribery. Grassley, in his letter, asserts certain FBI personnel allegedly attempted to sweep the form under the rug in part of a falsely attributing it to foreign disinformation. Barr, in early 2020, issued new rules and restrictions for opening investigations into politically sensitive individuals or entities, including requiring regular updates and that he approve any inquiry into a presidential candidate or campaign. Barr's memo followed a critical report from the Justice Department Inspectors General on aspects of the FBI's Russia investigation, which began in the summer of 2016 during the presidential campaign. Barr was also explicit about his concerns around how foreign disinformation might impact investigations, stating no information coming out of Ukraine could have been taken at face value given the amount of politically driven disinformation that could emerge from that country. Ex-FBI Timothy Tybalt, who Grassley asserts was ordered to close an avenue of additional derogatory Hunter Biden reporting in October of 2020, testified that the confidential source who was temporarily shut down was a conservative author and activist, Peter Schweizer, who is a senior contributor for the far-right media organization Breitbart News and not considered an unbiased source. Schweizer, president of the conservative-backed Government Accountability Institute, identified himself as the source in a podcast. Grassley said that he will seek interviews from at least 25 DOJ and FBI personnel involved in the efforts to investigate the Biden family. Based on the information provided to my office over a period of years of multiple credible whistleblowers, there appears to be an effort within the Justice Department and FBI but shut down investigative activity relating to the Biden family, Grassley wrote in a letter. Such decision points to make to significant political bias infecting the decision-making of not only the Attorney General and the FBI Director, but also line agents and prosecutors. A republic cannot survive such a political infection, and you have an obligation to this country to clear the air. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Saturday, October 28th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries, starting with Mary Jane Burton. Mary Jane Burton, 75, of Sioux City, passed away peacefully on Sunday, October 22nd, 2023, at the Westwood Rehabilitation Center after her four-month battle with cancer. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, October 28th, 2023, at the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Interment will be at the Cavalry Cemetery. Visitation with family present will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday evening at the Blessed Sacrament with a vigil service at 7 p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Pallbearers will be Nicholas Burton Jr., Michael Burton, Nicholas Burton Sr., Donald Charlson, Robert Charlson, and Patrick Cooper. Janie was born on December 16th, 1947, in Sioux City to Harold and Mary Donna Charlson. She graduated from Bishop Heelan High School. She went on to get her associate's degree in nursing at Western Iowa Technical School and cared for patients in hospitals, nursing homes, and outpatient clinics for 25 years. Janie worked in customer service. Janie was married to K. David Burton for 15 years and brought four children into the world. She dedicated her life to her children, living in Omaha, Nebraska, and Grand Rapids, Michigan, before returning to Sioux City. Janie will be remembered for her devout faith, levity of spirit, and joyful laughter. She was the longtime member of the Blessed Sacrament Parish. She enjoyed daily Mass and sharing her life of prayer with her community. Janie is survived by her children, Anne Burton of Philadelphia, Daniel Burton of Knoxville, Nicholas Burton of Knoxville, Burton of Brandenburg, six grandchildren, brother Robert Charlson of Sioux City, brother Don Charlson of Rochester, and sister Anita Cooper of Olathe, and 10 nieces and nephews and dear friends, Andy and Catherine Shell. Preceding her in death are her parents, Harold and Mary Donna Charlson, brother Alan Charlson, and baby brother Richie Charlson. Don R. Haddon, 87, of Sergeant Bluff, formerly of Soldier, Iowa, went to be with Jesus on Monday, October 23rd, 2023, at the Elmwood Care Center, surrounded by his family. A celebration of life will be at 2 p.m. Sunday, November 5th, 2023, at the Central Baptist Church in Sioux City, with Pastor Lloyd Grant officiating. A live stream of the service will be posted on the Glossar Funeral Home website with Don's obituary. Burial will be held at a later date in the Jordan Township Cemetery, rural Soldier, Iowa. Arrangements are under the direction of Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments in Onawa, Iowa. Condolences may be left online for the family at www.goslarfuneralhome.com. Jack F. Peter. Jack F. Peter, 80, passed away on October 24th, 2023. Visitation and services will be at the Isles Westover Chapel on Saturday, November 4th, 2023, with visitation beginning at 12:30 p.m. and a service to follow at 2 p.m., A private family interment will be at the McDivitt Grove Cemetery, with the military honors following the service. Jack was born February 16, 1943, in Danbury, Iowa, to Edward and Helen Peter. He graduated from Danbury High School. Following high school, he enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1964 and faithfully served his country during the Vietnam War. He was honorably discharged in 1972. On April 1st, 1967, he was united in marriage to Janet Johnson in Sioux City. They had two daughters, Jill and Jenny. In 1980, they moved to Urbandale, Iowa, where they made their home. Jack was a pilot and worked as an aircraft salesman for Des Moines Flying Services for 31 years. He retired in 2011. He was a member of the St. Teresa Catholic Church and Des Moines Woodworkers. He was also a life member of the NRA and the VFW 9668 post. In 1990, he helped found the West Des Moines Elks Lodge 2752, where he was an active member. Jack enjoyed woodworking, boating, fishing, target shooting, birding, and loving to travel the Midwest with his wife. His favorite water was the Mississippi River. Jack was preceded in death by his parents, a brother Keith, nephew Tony Peter, and niece Holly Jo DeVers. He is survived and lovingly remembered by his wife Janet, daughters Jill Feldman of Centerview, Jenny Kramer of Windsor Heights, four grandchildren, Margaret Terry, Nathan Feldman, Lucas Kramer, and Olivia Kramer, three great-grandchildren, Declan, Whitley, and Weston, as well as siblings Pat Peter and Mary Dermott of all of Sioux City, and a sister-in-law, Vicki Peters of Memphis, Tennessee. Memorials and contributions in memory of Jack may be directed to the St. Teresa Catholic School or the WDM Elks Lodge, 2752. John K. Barkley. John K. Barkley, 93, of Sioux City, passed away surrounded by his family October 23, 2023. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, October 28th. At the St. Michael's Catholic Church, with Father David Hemmen officiating. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, October 27th, at the St. Michael's Catholic Church. A vigil service will be held at 7 p.m. Burial will be at the Cavalry Cemetery. John Kenneth Barkley was born July 26, 1930, in Sioux City, Iowa, to Franklin and Rose Barkley. He was a member of the Holy Cross Parish in St. Michael Catholic Church and the Hinton Legion. He served with the United States Army for 2 years during the Korean conflict. He married Sally Jepson on November 10, 1956 in Bakersfield, California, and to this union, 7 children were born. They raised their family in Sioux City. He was self-employed with Barkley Construction, always liked to tell people that he was a ditch digger. He loved John Deere tractors and loved being a member of the Pioneer Club. He volunteered often at the church, especially at the fish dinners. Mornings with the coffee shop buddies was a highlight of his day. Those left to honor his memory include his children, Michael Barkley and Melinda Barkley of Sioux City, Iowa, Michelle Shelley Bolke of Hinton, Iowa, and Maurice Bomber Barkley of Overland Park, Kansas, Marshall Barkley of Monica, Marshall Barkley, Monica Salinger, and Marcia Dottie of McMahon, Roscoe, Illinois. Grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren, many relatives and friends. He is preceded in death by his wife, Sally, his parents, his brother, Jim Barkley, and his sister, Mary Barkley. Now let's move on to some sports articles with Fairbanks Pick 6 sends EPJ to semis. Huskies outlast Tri-Valley to gain 11B rematch with winner. Ashton Fairbanks was given was opportunity, and he turned it into not only a game-winning interception, but return for a touchdown, but a play that ultimately extended the Elk Point Jefferson High School football team's season. Just after the Tri-Valley crossed the midfield with under 6 minutes left Thursday night's Class 11B state playoff quarterfinals game, Elk Point, the Mustangs faced a third and long. Quarterback Eli McFarland dropped back to pass in an attempt to extend the drive as time dwindled in a 7-7 tied game. After McFarland avoided what several Husky defenders, he rolled to his right, heaved the ball up as he was being brought down, hoping a Tri-Valley receiver would be able to make a play. Fairbanks had other ideas. The 6'1", 200-pound junior linebacker made a leaping, bobbling interception and then returned it 45 yards for a touchdown, giving the Huskies a 14-7 lead with 5 minutes and 25 seconds left in the game. I tipped the ball, and I saw it still up in the air, Fairbanks said of his second interception of the season. It fell back down to me, and I ran all the way home with it. We weren't playing our best early on, but by the end, we felt like an unstoppable team. The score would stand as the final, sending the EPJ into the semifinals. The Huskies, who won their first state title last season, will be traveling to top-seeded winner Friday in a rematch with the 2022 championship game at the Dakota Dome. Winners has been the best team so far, and they're going to be a challenge, said Fairbanks. It wasn't the first time that Elk Point Jefferson had to make a comeback against Tri-Valley. The kids just have that never-quit attitude, said Elk Point Jefferson head coach Jake Terry. They worked all summer, all year for this opportunity. We were down at the half like we were the first time we played Tri-Valley, but our defense was unbelievable and our staff made great adjustments. The game followed a similar narrative as the first time the two sides played the season. An October 6th game that ended in a 24-14 win for the EPJ. We got down 14-0 the first time we played them, EPJ senior Garrett Merkley said. The second half, we just turned it on. I had never had any doubts in my guys. Ashton had an incredible game and made a huge play. Not that either defense needed any help in the quarterfinal game, but the wet and cold conditions set the stage for a ground-and-pound contest that saw the Huskies make another game-altering play on special teams when it blocked a Tri-Valley punt on the Mustangs' opening drive of the second half. That set up a 2-yard touchdown run by junior Gunnar Ewing after the 5'9", 170-pound running back took a direct snap and blasted through the line of scrimmage to tie it 7-7 after a successful Carson Timmons extra point with 7 minutes 46 seconds left in the third. At any time you get a short field like that, that's a big, big play, Terry said. And then that pick six was just awesome. I don't know if I've seen anything like it, but it was pretty awesome. You'll love to see it. We lost so many kids from last season, the 11B state champion. People expect us to be down a little bit, but this is the third year in a row we've made it to the semis. It just speaks volumes about these kids and the standard, and I don't expect anything less. That pride the kids have is just an invaluable part to this program. Elk Point Junior's Jefferson's senior running back, Jake Gale, had a game-high 78 yards on 16 carries. His younger brother, junior quarterback Keaton Gale, had 45 rushing yards on 11 carries and was 4 of 10 passing for 23 yards. This is awesome, Keaton Gale said. The first half wasn't great, but that blocked punt turned the game right there. After that, we had all the energy and we were all fired up. Merkley added 65 rushing yards on just 5 totes, and he was essential in keeping the EPJ drives alive and the chains moving. He also had a 76-yard touchdown run called back due to a holding infraction. The Huskies tallied 12 first downs for the game to Tri-Valley's 6. I think everything just fell into place together. Once one thing went our way, everything did. Special teams started with the blocked punt, and the offense and the defense just fed off that. Once we had some momentum, it's hard to stop us. Our goal is to get back to the Dakota Dome for the championship game. Prior to the Ewing score, the game's two biggest plays were made by the Mustangs. After EPJ went three and out on its opening dive of the game, the Tri-Valley's Brody Diffbig went 57 yards on 4th-and-2 to set up a Colby Catherer's score from 7 yards out to put a Tri-Valley up 7 with five into the game. Diffbig ended with a team high 86 rushing yards on 7 carries. Carruthers carried 12 times for 37 yards, and McFarland was 2 of 6 passing for 9 yards. At halftime, we talked about just playing disciplined, going to what we normally would do and do it well, said Keaton Gale. The Merkley would-be score was a bummer, but we just came up back in the huddle and decided we could do it again and run the ball down their throats. The Huskies responded with one of the best drives of the game to that point and were threatening inside the Tri-Valley 10-yard line, but the Mustangs turned the table on EPJ with a fumble recovery. We beat ourselves in the first half, Terry said, but in the second half, we controlled the ball and the clock and really leaned on our defense. Final little subheader here at the end. The Panthers fall short. Dakota Valley fell in the first round of the South Dakota Class 11A playoffs Thursday night to Sioux Falls Christian 24-13. No team or individual stats were immediately available from the game played in Sioux Falls. Number 4 seed Sioux Falls Christian advances to face top seed Del Rapids in the semifinals on November 3rd. Dakota Valley closes the season at 6-4. Now I'll take a look at some of the sports that are lined up for tomorrow, Sunday, October 29th. Starting with Australian Rules Football, women's, AFL Port Adelaide at Hawthorne on FS1 at 1 a.m., Auto Racing, the FIM MotoGP, the OR Thailand Grand Prix Isan in Thailand. It's taped on CNBC at 12 p.m. NASCAR Cup Series, the Xfinity 500 Playoffs, Round of 8 at Martinsville Speedway, Martinsville, Virginia, on NBC at 1 p.m. Formula 1, the Mexico Grand Prix, Autodromo, Hernandos Rodriguez, Mexico City, on ABC at 1:30 p.m., and the World Superbike Round 12, Cadiz, Spain, taped on CNBC at 1:30. NHRA qualifying, the strip at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, Las Vegas, taped FS1 at 2 p.m. And the NHRA Nevada Nationals, the strip at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, Las Vegas, at FS1 at 4 p.m. College basketball men's exhibition, Tennessee at Michigan State on BTN at 2:30 p.m. Exhibition, Kansas at Illinois on BTN at 5 p.m. College cross country, Big Ten championships from Madison, Wisconsin on BTN at 8 a.m. College soccer men's, Penn State at Wisconsin on BTN at 11:30 a.m., Stanford at California on Pac-12 Network at 4 p.m., and Oregon State at UCLA on the Pac-12 Network at 6 p.m. Then we have college soccer women's, Southeastern Tournament, LSU versus Kentucky, first round, Pensacola, Florida, on SECN at 1 p.m. We have Santa Clara at Gonzaga, Santa Clara at Gonzaga on ESPNU and Stanford at UCLA on Pac-12 Network, both at 2 p.m. Southeastern Tournament, Tennessee versus Auburn, first round, Pensacola, Florida on SECN, 3:30 p.m. Atlantic Coast Tournament, Wake Forest at Clemson, first round on ACCN at 5 p.m. Atlantic Coast Tournament, Pittsburgh at North Carolina, first round on ACCN at 7 p.m. We have college volleyball women's, Clemson at Boston College on ACCN at 11 a.m., and Auburn at Alabama on SECN at 11 a.m., Oklahoma at Iowa State on ESPN at 12 p.m., and ESPN and Houston at Cincinnati on ESPNU at 12 p.m., Virginia Tech at Virginia on ACN, and Ohio State at Michigan on FS1, both at 1 p.m., Oregon at Washington on ESPN at 2 p.m. and NC State at North Carolina on ACCN at 3 p.m. Minnesota at Wisconsin on FS1, 3:45 p.m. We've got NBA basketball, San Antonio at LA Clippers on NBA TV at 8 p.m. NFL football, we have regional coverage, Atlanta at Tennessee, New England at Miami, New York Jets at New York Giants, Jacksonville at Pittsburgh on CBS at 12 p.m. And regional coverage, LA Rams at Dallas, Minnesota at Green Bay, New Orleans at Indianapolis, Philadelphia at Washington, and Houston at Carolina on Fox, and that's also at 12 p.m. We have Cleveland at Seattle on Fox at 3:05 p.m. Regional coverage, Kansas City at Denver, Baltimore at Arizona, and Cincinnati at San Francisco on CBS on 3:25 p.m. And Chicago at L.A. Chargers on NBC at 7:20 p.m. NHL hockey, we have the Heritage Classic, Calgary versus Edmonton in Edmonton, Alberta, on TBS at 6 p.m. We have men's soccer, U.S. Premier League. There's Premier League, Everton at West Ham United on USA at 8 a.m. Bundesliga, Borussia Dortmund at Eintracht Frankfurt on ESPN2 at 9:25 p.m. MLS playoffs, New York Red Bulls at FC Cincinnati Game 1, FS1, at 7 p.m. And MLS playoffs, Sporting Kansas City at St. Louis City, Game 1 on FS1 at 9 p.m. We have women's soccer. We have international friendly U.S. versus Colombia in San Diego. That's on TNT at 4:30 p.m. Then we have tennis. We have WTA Elite Trophy Zhuhai Singles Final at 2 a.m. on tennis. Looks like all these channels are on the tennis channel. Vienna ATP, Basel ATP Singles Final at 8 a.m. WTA Finals Double Round Robin, 2:30 p.m. WTA Finals Singles and Doubles Round Robin, 5 p.m. WTA Finals Singles and Doubles Round Robin Paris ATP Early Rounds at 5 a.m. on Monday. And then volleyball women's, we have Athletes Unlimited, Team Linham versus Team Edmond in Mesa, Arizona on ESPNU at 8:30 p.m. Now let's go on to the article. North High's Kiffle takes third at state cross-country meet. Alta Arula Peterson takes fourth place in Class 1A girls. Sioux City North's Nathaniel Kiffle ended his prep cross-country career on the medal stand at Friday's Iowa High School State Cross-Country Championships. Kiffle, a senior at North, took third in boys' Class 4A race at Kennedy Park in Fort Dodge, with a time of 15 minutes, 25.6 seconds. As a junior, he took 17th and ran a time of nearly a full minute faster this time around. In 2021, when North was a runner-up as a team, Kiffle ended up in 8th place. Four-time state qualifier, Kiffle was also a member of the 2020 state champion squad and took 34th individually. Ankeny junior Ethan Zuber won the race with a time of 15 minutes 7.7 seconds. And Cedar Falls sophomore Jaden Merrick was runner-up at 5 minutes 13.4 seconds. North junior Connor Schultz took 57th place. In the girls' Class 1A race, Alta Aurelia's Nora Peterson took 4th to cap off her junior season, while West Monona sophomore Chloe Brower finished 24th. Junior Noelle Steinis of Calamus Wheatland captured her third state 1A cross-country title with a time of 18 minutes 22 seconds. North Lynn senior Megan Wheatley was a runner-up, and Alyssa Richmond Manson, Northwest Webster Jr., was third. Last season, Peterson took third in 1A behind Steins and Sibley Okudan's Madison Brewer, who's now running both cross-country and track at the University of South Dakota. The Hinton girls team qualified as a squad and took 13th out of 16 teams in the competition with a score of 250. Hinton was led by senior Kyra Peters in the personal best time of 20 minutes 40.1 seconds, as she placed 45th as an individual. Blackhawk senior Cadence Peters took 61st, and Madrid girls won the 1A team competition with a score of 97. On the boys' side, in the 1A, Sibley Okudan sophomore Ben Byers finished 13th to finish the season with a PR. MMCRU senior Caden Gals also PR'd on Friday with a time of 16 minutes and 57.8 seconds. It took 22nd. In the team competition, Sibley Okudan took 16th with a score of 337, well behind the team title winner Lake Mills' score of 111. Alta Aurelia sophomore Jacob Launderville placed just inside the top 50 in the 1A boys race. North sophomore Hannah Johnson was the only area qualifier in the 4A girls race. She took 117th with a time of 20 minutes and 44.7 seconds out of 130 runners. The state meet continues on Saturday with the 2A girls and the boys race starting at 11:30 a.m. and finishes with the girls and the boys 3A competition at 2 p.m. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Saturday, October 28th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.